John can do it. John can walk around.
I guess I can. I'm voluntold.
Just ignore the man. All right, as John said, we're just going to do a midrash. What I'm going to do is, because, you know, I didn't have a lot of time. So I'm just going to read a couple of verses, maybe lead a question or two, and then open it up for people who have comments, questions, anything that you want, as long as it doesn't go off in a weird, really weird rabbit trail, John. So, yeah, I know it. It goes John's part of it anyway. All right, so we're in Exodus 12, 29 through 51 today. And if I can find it, that's chapter 13. There it is. All right, so we're going to start in 29, and I'll just read 29 to 30. And I don't know, like I said, it takes me like 2 weeks to even come up with what I'm going to talk about, and then another 2 weeks to put it together. So this was, I did this last night and the night before. So hopefully y'all have something to say. Otherwise, we're going to be eating in like 10 minutes. All right. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on the throne, to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all of his officials and the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. So when I first come into this Torah thing, and I'm reading this and everything, and I thought that it was pretty sad that everybody, that all the firstborn, why would he do that to somebody in the dungeon? They didn't have a choice to put the blood on the lintel, so to speak. So why was there the death of the firstborn to start with? Why not confine the death to just the Pharaoh or the court or those opposed to Yahweh and Moses? Why the firstborn of the prisoners and even of the animals? Those are the questions that I started with when I first started doing this. I still don't have quite an answer why the animals had to die, but there's a reason for it. So I'm hoping that, you know, as we open this discussion, everybody has an opinion on everything. We all have an opinion. And I'm going to try and leave my opinions out of it today. That's really hard because I have lots of them. So does anybody have any comments or questions or answers or anything that they saw with right here that, you know, they want to talk about? Raise your hand. And Bill, thank you, Bill. John, Bill's right here.
Oh, I'm looking at the back. Hello. The first thing I find interesting that Pharaoh did not die, which means he was not the firstborn. I usually thought the firstborn were descended. So what happened to the other one guy?
But that's a good point. That's a good point.
You know, now those animals, a lot of them are going to be food for the fodder anyway. I mean, they're going to be eaten eventually anyway, so I'm not sure that really matters so much, those. But the people, it wasn't that the firstborn died, it means everybody else got to live.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, it really is. But yeah, Pharaoh wasn't the firstborn. This is something I didn't think of, you know. Anyway.
Usually it's the firstborn who inherits
the
kingdom.
That has a lot to do with the inheritance. Becky?
Well, wouldn't the animals, the firstborn or whatever of the animals, have died because you're supposed to take the first of your season?
The flock.
And sacrifice, even though the, you know, Egyptians or pagan people didn't really follow God's word, they still believed in those rituals, traditions, whatever you want to call them. So maybe that's why he took the firstborn of the livestock?
Mm-hmm. He didn't take the firstborn of the livestock in for the Israelites, did he? I think that might have something to do with the lamb. I'm not quite sure. Bill again. We just might as well just keep it right here. Everybody move up front.
What livestock? I thought they lost their stuff already before.
No.
So I know they lost a lot of their stuff. So maybe they acquired more from the Jews. And maybe some of that wasn't theirs to begin with anyway, that they lost.
Mm. Very well could have been, because they didn't do certain animals. They didn't like sheep, things like that, because they were, that was, you know, pagan to them, I guess. Okay, anybody else with that?
I have a question.
Trish, and then Haro.
The whole chart that we looked at a couple weeks ago about the different gods that they had set up, and that God brought all those plagues against Egypt, kind of to tear down what the frog king, the frog god was, or the, I don't know what the other gods were. I didn't see the whole chart, but is there something to do with the firstborn as being something set up as to go with the chart? I don't know. I haven't looked at the chart, but I'm wondering if it has to do with firstborn being the premier something, and so they all needed to be taken out, or
maybe
I don't know. I don't know if that has anything to do with
Could
anything.
Be. Yeah, and Pharaoh's, the killing of Pharaoh's firstborn would take away his sovereignty, I think. He's no longer a god. He, well, you know, even though he didn't die, his firstborn did, so that would be cutting off the kingship in a way, I guess. I don't know.
Well, she just gave me the chart here, and it says something about this plague was a judgment on all of Egypt's gods, all of them, including Pharaoh himself, because kings were considered gods at the time, right?
So what would be who is the god of death? John, you should know that. I see, put him on the spot, and he doesn't know anything.
Like Isis, Ra, who is that? No, I don't know. I'm just throwing out names.
Osiris?
I don't know.
In the Egyptian thing.
Yeah.
It says, in Exodus 1, Pharaoh had killed the sons of Israel. So now the Lord kills the firstborn sons of the Egyptians, and Pharaoh will now let Israel go. He will later lose his army to death in the Red Sea. So anyway, I'm just reading. Maybe that's the end.
Yeah, I know. Haro had something. Your dad had something.
Anubis.
I should have known that. I watched a lot of Stargate shows.
So I have a thought here. So Yahweh was actually trying to separate himself from them because, you know, he was hardening the heart and all that. And here in Exodus says, "You shall set apart to the Lord all your first open all the first open the womb, all the firstborn to the of your animals that are males should be to the Lord." So maybe that's what it was too. Like he was just trying to like for him to judge them and like do what everything like, you know, he had to like draw the line and be like, okay, this is how I'm gonna depart myself from you guys.
Makes sense to me. Anybody else? No?
I was thinking the same thing when he was talking about the males, because he killed the firstborn males. So that could have been the animals that were males, firstborns, possibly.
Very well could be. They couldn't, you know, you kill the male off, and you can't have any more children if you kill the male off. Mm-hmm. Seems to be what we're doing in this society today. Okay. That's all I got right there. I can't see that far. Oh, I see.
It's a comment, but just a question. So I know when they killed all the firstborn, it took everybody out, I think, but the firstborn of Israel, right? Or the people that were associated with Israel at that time. So and him wiping out the firstborn, was that like God taking out any chance that anybody that is not going to be with him, like even the potential that they could even like prosper? Because they were wiped out if they were not Israel or they were not connected, then they got wiped out. So there's no chance of them coming back if they had no firstborn. I don't know. That's what I was thinking just now.
Well, it's cutting into the covenant. If you're not part of the covenant, if you haven't put the blood on the lintels, then you cannot have a relationship with Yahweh. That's what the whole Passover is about, is the being, you know, integrated into the community, into the covenant of Yahweh. So killing off the firstborn of those that are not in the covenant certainly could go a long way to taking off the next generation.
So. I found another verse here, Luke chapter 2, verse 23. It says, every male who first opened the womb shall be called holy to the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't say just every Israel or every believer. He says every male. So, okay. No.
Anybody else? Nope.
It doesn't distinguish male or female firstborn. It just says the firstborn.
Well, it's usually the males that are killed off. They're the ones that...
Yahweh killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting in his throne to the firstborn of the prisoner in the dungeon, and all firstborn of the livestock.
Hmm. I didn't look it up. But it could... I don't understand why he'd kill off all the female, though, of the firstborn.
With the wages of sin.
It could.
The wages of sin is death.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else? You want to move on? Oh, we're going to go home really early. All right. So I'm just going to read the next couple verses. Oh, I'm sorry.
I did not.
It depends on what translation you use. Because mine doesn't say, it just says firstborn. It really depends on your translation and who translated your Bible. And I don't think that it would be too far of a stretch to put firstborn male in there. But, you know, the Bibles that I have don't say male, you know, and I have... What translation do you have?
It's an iPhone translation.
It's an iPhone.
Bible for women.
Well. Okay. I can see why that works. Yep. We will leave that right there.
29.
Of 12. Yeah, mine doesn't say that though. Well, it's attached to Exodus 4 something. Wow, we could take all this time talking about men. Oh. If we go back to Exodus 4, verse 23, it says, let my son go so he may worship me, but you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son. Now that's, you know, not talking about all of Israel or anything, but it is still in Egypt. So it very well could be just the firstborn son. Or male, or whatever it is. Right. Martin?
It's important to point out that it's not really, well, the translations might put men in there, but in the Masoretic text, man is not in there. It's not men. So a translator could add it, but it's definitely not in the Hebrew Masoretic text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's not in the Septuagint either.
Right, yeah.
Because I did look into the Septuagint also. Because anytime that you're confused about words, Mike's always telling us, go back to the original. If you are confusing, go into look into the Septuagint, which is where Jansenius gets his. It's the Greek version of the Hebrew. So whatever is in there is usually always the words that should be used because they copied it right from Hebrew.
Yeah.
Damien?
I mean, which is going to have more of an impact? The firstborn male or the firstborn?
Yeah.
It's going to be the firstborn male.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't matter if the female is firstborn to Pharaoh, that female is not ruling. He could have 12 daughters and then one male.
Yeah.
And that male is going to rule.
Yeah.
So it's going to be in every society and every culture throughout time. The male is going to be the one that's going to inherit everything all throughout the Bible. Mm-hmm. So to kind of be picking here and there and then to actually look at the history of the Bible and the importance that Yahweh puts on the firstborn male everywhere, it's kind of safe to, I know it may be wrong to assume in some situations, but the greater impact of Egyptian society at that point in time would be killing off the firstborn male in a household.
Any society.
Any society.
Look at the society that we live in today.
Yeah.
And what they have done to the young boys.
Yeah, exactly. That's who they attack.
Most every transitioner that you read about is male to female.
Yeah.
And that's just another way of the enemy killing off the
firstborn. Yeah, and we can see it clear, and it's, they're disregarded, saying, you're wrong if you think you're naturally this way.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, there's a greater effect, a greater kind of force happening with this, not just some curious people.
Absolutely. Anybody else? All right. Okay. We'll move along then. Get off this mill thing, you know? All right. In verse 31. I'm just going to read about three or four of them at a time. It says, during the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, up, leave my people, you and your Israelites. Go, worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds as you have said, go, but also bless me. Now, I'll stop there. What an arrogant man. You know, you just don't do some bad things to somebody and at the end of the day going, ask your God to give me some blessings. You know, that just seems kind of wrong.
messing
with the blessings. But, you know, we read our Bible and we all tend to think that the Bible is a history book. It's not actually a history book. It's an historical book. But it doesn't give you blow-by-blow history like history books do. But everything in here is history. So I thought I would preface the rest of this, you know, when we go into how many people were there at the Exodus and everything, is when scholars go to look at things, when it comes to the Exodus, there's not a lot of external things to find. You don't find mass graves in the Sinai Desert. You don't find these things. So they take what they call internal and external things to make up the story of the Exodus. So when we get to the rest of the stuff, you got to kind of think that these are stories written by people back then, and they're written in a prose called not warrior, but battlesmiths. Everything you find here is like superhero comic books. Moses is the superhero coming to save Egypt. He has the external father coming to help him. So when we look at all these things, we have to remember the culture of the time, the cultural river in which this was sown in, and we are standing on another cultural river trying to figure it all out. And we can't keep crossing the streams putting what we think into things. And sometimes I do that. I'll read something and I'll overlie it with today and put it that way and understand it that way. But that's wrong for me to do too. But these stories are, you think about it, this book is a miracle that we even have it, because they were stories told by word over and over and over again. That's why we are told every year to remember and participate in Passover, because then we have the chance to tell our children and the next generation what's going on. So we've got this epic telling of this wonderful salvation story, you know. But then you have this man who stands there, and after everything that he has done, he wants the blessing of God. Well, that's pretty arrogant. So that's my opinion. I said I wasn't going to give my opinion. Anybody have anything to say about that?
Something they did back then. We look at blessings of God here, and you have righteousness is part of it. But then, if you think about pagan ritual and pagan worship of gods, it's like, whatever, just give the sacrifice, just get the blessing. You don't have to be good, you don't have to do anything. And it's almost like he's just another god. Just tell him to be good to me. You know, it doesn't matter what I did. And it's like how little they thought. Because I think it's interesting always to look back at their gods. Like, they still believed he existed. It's not like they didn't think God, their God, wasn't real. You know, like, they saw that. Everybody had a real God. It wasn't like, no, prove it. It was like, if you said you had a God, you had a God. Mm-hmm. But they just didn't think he was all-powerful. And then now Pharaoh's like, well, just tell him to bless me because he works just like all the other gods that I worship work, and just put in a good word for me and we're okay. And yeah, it's the arrogance there that makes you think he doesn't, he deserves everything bad that happened to him, because it's just like the kind of culture that they came from, Egypt. And it's a blessing that they got out, and it was like, all right, you guys need to leave. And how much of that actually radiates within what we see happen to them in the desert? You know, it's like, how much of that culture did they keep? I think that's always an interesting thing, because I always saw it as like a clean slate, but it's like, how much did they bring with them? Not just with ideas of gods, but as their person, as their kind of reflection of
Pharaoh.
They had
to have taken a ton because exactly. They didn't have their own traditions.
Exactly. So it's like when you keep that in mind and you see the mistakes they make, they're like, I guess that's how Egypt was. And then, yeah, you can see that now with Pharaoh. It's like, just bless me. It doesn't matter what I did.
Oh, a friend of mine told me that she thought that Pharaoh's heart was so humbled that he was actually wanting a blessing from the true God, because, as you know, Trish was talking about the gods of Egypt, he killed off every god of Egypt through every plague, even down to the god of death, proving that there is no god but Yahweh. So I don't know how far I can go into Pharaoh's heart being humbled. But Bill?
I think Pharaoh choked big time.
Choked.
Major. Look, at this time, he'd obviously know what's going on. If he was really seeking God, he would not have called for Moses and Aaron. He would have gotten his chariot and drove to them instead.
Uh-huh.
And if he's really seeking God, he would bow down and he would have said, I am wrong, I am sorry. And there's nothing like that here at all. Yeah. So, and think about it, how much different would it have been if he had done
that? If he had, yeah.
He probably would have gone swimming in the Red Sea later on.
Yeah, swimming.
Well, speaking of tradition, even though he saw, Pharaoh saw his gods being squashed by Pharaoh, and then he wanted to believe, and so he released the people. That's what Moses was asking, you know, release my people. But then he said, bless me. Then traditionally, he knew. It was so ingrained in his brain that, you know, these are the gods, this is the way we've been raised, this is the way it's been for generations, this is what I have to believe, this is the way I have to lead my people. And traditionally, you know, my dad and I, and he was an elder in the Church of Christ and whatnot for years, and we had this conversation about when I first started doing away with Christmas and doing away with Easter, and you know, and he sent me articles about, you know, the pagan under whatever in Christmas and Easter. And so, but traditionally, it's so ingrained in people's minds that this is Christ's birthday, this is Christ when he rose, that they almost feel guilty for not celebrating it. And my dad had even said, well, do both. You know, why can't you do Christmas and Hanukkah or Easter and Passover? And I said, because it's pagan.
Well, it's, even if you leave off the word pagan, it's not biblical.
Yeah.
That's the art, because I used to have my big, huge Torah hammer and go wide swaths of people, mowing them down. And I had to learn to leave the word pagan off of everything that I said, because it turns people so far away from wanting to hear that it's just not biblical.
Right.
Christmas is not biblical.
That's what I had to say.
Church of Christ, that's interesting. I grew up in the Church of Christ.
Really?
We knew that it wasn't his birthday. Mm-hmm. The Church of Christ actually taught that it wasn't his birthday, but nobody knew, so we had to pick that day. And since the old people did it, the church did it, so we're going to do it this way. Yeah. But I grew up very fortunate, because my mother never made a big deal about it. Ever made a big deal. We had the Christmas tree, and we had some gifts and Christmas music, but we never did a big deal about it. So I was really blessed that way. Until I didn't do it anymore, and my mother was very upset. Which, you know, well, you can send the kids candy anytime you want. Because that's what she would do. She would make us Christmas candy. And then it was end of the year candy. And then it was Hanukkah candy. But the candy was good. Homemade, oh yeah. Bill? Oh, sorry. Sorry, I didn't see you, Hiro. Either one, doesn't matter. Bill's right here.
Well, in Zechariah 14, it doesn't talk anything about Easter or Xmas there. No. And there's only one holiday I see in the future, and that's Sukkot. And I think that's when Jesus was born anyway. John, the Gospel of John chapter 1 says he was born among men and he tabernacled among us. Mm-hmm. I think that's when it was. So, yeah, I do think we should celebrate it. But not in December.
Not in December.
In the fall.
Yeah. In the fall. Yes. When they were in the actual sukkahs. I don't know how people get that, but Christmas. Go ahead, Hero.
Just by Pharaoh saying that he wants the blessings, it kind of reminds me what people do. Like growing up, you know, I had my mom go to church for me and have my mom pray for me, you know, and I wanted the blessings. And it's like you have to have like this intimacy relationship with God himself, not just want, you know. He's like, oh yeah, you know, tell your God, give me the blessings, or, you know, but he wasn't willing to step down and accept God as his God. So there's more to that. But yeah, it's kind of like being a hypocrite or whatnot, you know. So, you know, just almost like asking, I don't know, Elon Musk for $1 million. He has billions. And I was like, hey, just give me a little bit, you know. But who's Elon Musk? He don't even know me. So, you know, just like that. So, I mean, I'm not comparing the blessings of God to him, but it's just so beyond that. You have to have this relationship where it's like, yeah, I do know you. I do, you know. So just asking is not enough. Just saying it is not enough. You actually have to show your faith by your works.
Yeah, you have to walk the walk. Yeah. And talk to talk, yeah. Although, do you think Yahweh blesses people who don't believe in him?
Because he is kind and sends the rain on even the evil and the unbreakable.
Yeah. Because he shows his goodness to everyone, no matter who they are. You know, and I think when I was first coming back and really getting into, you know, the Bible and everything, I thought, that was wrong. People shouldn't be blessed for not doing what he tells you to do. But how ungrateful my heart was, you know, because he gave me all these things, all this peace and all this, you know, everything. And I'm telling him, don't do that to them, people. They don't deserve that. You know, bad person. I'm not just bad. Anybody else? All right, so we'll just move along. Verse 33. The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, for otherwise, they said, we will all die. So the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked for. So they plundered the Egyptians. I got a kick out of reading this yesterday because I find the word urgent and urgent and leaving and all that, they're all the same words. It's the word hazak. It's Strong's 2380. Strong and urgent. They strongly urged the people to leave. That's what it means. They hardened or strengthened and encouraged them for Israel to leave. They were terrified that they were going to die like the firstborn. So, and when they asked them, asked for the money, the word and the word asked is the same word. And it basically means to borrow or lend. So here I'm sitting here reading through Jacinius and going, these people are borrowing money from the Egyptians to leave. And the Egyptians are gleefully asking them, what do you need? Here, have money. When we were kids, literally when we were kids, I remember Mrs. Opal sitting there. The Killingsworth were the elders at our church, and she taught us. And she started throwing coins when she was saying, I'm going, this is awesome. We get money for ice cream and everything. So in my head, all of my life, I always thought that they were out there throwing money at the Israelites. Get out of here. Get out of here. But the word actually says that they were asking them what they needed, and Israel was plundering all the goods. And maybe they were all, some of them were greedy and asking for more. But I thought that was really weird and really interesting that this ask and the strong are basically all the same words. So I don't know. So what do y'all think? I'm going to shut my opinion up right now and leave it off. So nobody has anything to say. Wait, Bill's looking something up.
I don't see the words you're talking about.
It's in verse 33.
Okay.
So the Egyptians urged the people. Urged is one of the words. And then when they said, I can't read it right now. The word and, ask, and strong. They're all from the same family. And it's Strong's 2388, Hazak. That's the one that I got written down. Of course, I didn't write everything down because then it would have turned into a talk, and I couldn't do that. So I thought it was very strange that they were asking them, what do you want from us to just leave this place so I never have to look at you again? That's how I take what the Egyptians, how the Egyptians felt about the Israelites. I could be very wrong. Anybody have an opinion on that? Becky, thank you.
Basically, God had just taken their firstborn. They wanted to be rid of them.
Yeah. I'm surprised they weren't getting stoned. You know?
Right? I mean, like, if somebody took my firstborn, I wouldn't want to look at them ever again either. So
they'd be out there with gold bars sticking them in their head. Oh, anyone else?
No. Mm-hmm. They were saying, look, we're going to die too, so who knows what the next plague would be.
Oh, that's a good point.
So what else is going to happen? We've seen frogs come from the sky. We've seen hail. We've seen blood fire. We've seen blood.
But see,
all this stuff, what else, what's going to happen next? We can't handle it.
The only plague, really, truly, the only plague that they could not assign to something else, it's like the darkness. They have these 100-year sandstorms that just blanket everything and you can't see. you can kind of see like a light shadow. So in some of the historical books, it says that the Egyptians thought that they were under a sandstorm. And the reason that they could see light in Goshen was because it was the sun shining through the sandstorms. So all of the plagues, except for the last one, could have been explained away by natural phenomena, except for the death across the land and the animals and everything. You can't explain that away. Not even in conspiracies can you explain that away. So,
and the fact that it didn't hit Goshen.
Exactly. Actually, if you didn't have the blood on your doorpost, even in Goshen, the firstborn would have died, I believe. So Damien has something to talk about.
Well, it says favor. It doesn't say fear. We're describing fear. We're saying out of fear, they're giving them everything. But here it says Yahweh put favor.
Favor.
So are they happy that they're leaving, or are they happy as in now we don't have to, like, favor gave the people favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. So the Egyptians looked at them kindly. At least that's what it says here. But we're describing them as being afraid of the Israelites, saying, I'm afraid you get out. But it's almost like if they actually looked at them favorably, in goodness and in happiness, they're going to give them everything.
Yeah.
But if you look at somebody in fear, you're not going to give them everything. You know, you're going to try to hold back as much as you can. But if you look at them in favor, you're going to want to give them everything.
Well, I don't know. You could, in fear, throw anything that the person wants just as long as they leave. So I can see it both ways. But I know that there's a translation that says that the Egyptians encouraged the Israelites to leave. Mm-hmm. That could be in anger, too. They encouraged them in anger.
I guess I just look at favor as being an interesting concept because it's Yahweh turned their hearts.
Yeah.
Fear was there naturally. So why would Yahweh turn their hearts to fear them when they already clearly feared them because they experienced all the plagues because of them? Yeah. So what was it about the favor? How did they really, were they happy that the slaves were leaving? Like, good for you?
Probably.
You get to go to their God. It was just an interesting kind of turn that, yeah, of course it would be reasonable to say get out, but why does it point out here that he changed their hearts?
I'm sorry. I also had the thought that as they were getting ready to leave and were given all this stuff, did Abraham's words come to their minds? Because in Genesis 15, it talks about this. It talks about them coming out of captivity with, all these people and being given favor, being given possessions, great possessions. So when because I don't think they had a lot of traditions. I think they probably, in certain pockets, they must have had some kind of instructions in Abraham and all that stuff. But with Moses and Aaron coming back and talking to the people over this course of time, they had to have said something about the promises of Yahweh to Abraham. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, as they were leaving and all this stuff was coming at them, did they remember that? Mm-hmm. That they were to come out with great possessions? That's an interesting thing. I don't think I've ever read anything about it. But I thought that was interesting as I was looking through that.
Why do you think that some Egyptians joined them? Like, what was it about? Were they they're taking all their stuff. I want to go, too.
I have a big theory about that. I'll get there in the next verse. Everybody's going to laugh at me. Bill. And thank you guys for talking. It's Genesis 4.
Well, God did give them, they did have favor, but also if you go back to verse 33, it says, we all be dead men.
Yeah.
So I think they had a lot of grief. They also had a lot of fear. They probably had the favor, too. And so I think they're really emotional wrecks is probably what happened on there. I do see in verse 36, though, it says, so they lent unto them such things as they required. That's the only place in the Bible where it actually talks about lent.
Lent. Lent. And they walk around with a cross on their head?
No.
Oh, anyway. So, that it? Okay, so we'll move along. 37. The Israelites sojourned. Yeah, that's right. 36. Okay, the Israelites sojourned from Ramses to Sukkot. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Many other people went up to them, and also large droves of livestock and both flocks and herds. With the dough the Israelites had brought from Egypt, they baked loaves of unleavened bread. The dough was without yeast because they had been driven out of Egypt. And I'll just go finish this. And it says, and now the length of time the Israelites people lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of the 430 years, to the very day, all the Lord's divisions left Egypt, because the Lord kept vigil that night to bring them out of Egypt. On this day, all the Israelites are to keep vigil to honor the Lord for generations to come. So here's my big theory. The 600,000 plus the men and women and children, and then the mixed multitude. This is my theory. Nobody has to believe anything I say. I don't believe that there was that. I think if that number of 600,000 is actually to stand, that has to include the mixed multitude and the men and women. In the land around Ramses, where Egypt, where they were building the new thing for the Pharaoh, there's not enough land to handle that many people. In the estimation of the people who actually lived in Egypt at that time was only 2 to 3 million people spread out everywhere. So how can you get upwards of 2 million people into that one little thing and then walk to Sukkot? It would take a week from the front to the back to catch up. And then in order to get through the river, it would take over a week. Some estimate maybe even a month to get through the water. Obviously, God is in the miracle business, and he can do anything. He could have got those people through on the wing, right? But here's my big old theory. The mixed multitude were not believers. I don't believe that they believed like the Israelites. I kind of lean into the idea that in that mixed multitude, there were these people had to put the doorpost because they saw what happened. But at the end of the day, they were probably other slaves. They were probably people that lived on the streets. There were people who wanted to escape oppression. I really believe that's who these mixed multitude were. And before they hit Sukkot, I imagine some of those people ran away, hiding from Pharaoh, hiding from the patrols and stuff. Because even at that time, the largest army ever recorded was the Hittite army. And that was 36,000 people. That's it, 36,000 people. And they, of course, believe that's an overestimation. Most of your Egyptian people, what do they call them, garrisons or troops or whatever they are. The highest one that I read was only 2,000 men. And at one point, as they gathered together to fight a particular army, there were 20,000 of them, but they had come all from all over Egypt. So to have that many people go across the desert without anybody going, hey, look, what's all that dust out there? It's a little strange. So I printed something out. Let's see if I can find what I wrote, because if I can't find it, then we're just not going to talk about it. Oh, here it is. So this is from one of my study Bibles, and it's from a guy named Greg Kinnear. He says, the size of the Israelite population has been considered problematic for several reasons. If it were 600,000 men, the total group would have numbered over 2 million. It contended that the Delta region of Egypt could not have supported a population of that size. And the size of Egypt proper and all of its slaves may have been 4 million people. The modern population of the area in the Wadi, Tamut, where Ramses is, was only is under 20,000. Egyptian armies of this period were considered 20,000 or less. Indeed, for the battle of this particular thing, they actually got the Hittites to come in with 37,000 men to beat up the Egyptian army. And I wanted to find where they came through the desert, but I can't find it. I didn't highlight it. But if a couple of million people lived in the wilderness for 40 years and half of them died there, they expected to find more than a trace of who they were, but they did not. And I guess they've torn the desert up quite a bit. They found a lot of things that were Exodus things, but not the millions and millions of people that supposedly died in the desert. They found some mass graves of a couple hundred people here and a couple hundred people there, but not millions of them. So I thought it was really interesting to know that it doesn't matter how many went out. It matters how many crossed the Jordan in covenant, circumcised, ready to carry on Yahweh's word. So when I read all this, going, well, that doesn't make any sense, and that doesn't make any sense. So at the end of the day, I had to come to the conclusion that it doesn't matter how many goes across. It just a matter how many took up the mantle of Yahweh with his word and walked with that. So what do you all think about that, my little theory? Becky, thank you.
Well, I mean, obviously there were a lot of them because they were trying to kill the boys. I mean, Moses was, what, 30, 40 years old when all the Exodus took place, maybe older? Mm-hmm. So they were trying to kill all the firstborn that the Israelites were having, you know, generation ago or whatever. So they were obviously worried about their size back then.
Yeah, and if Israel had, think about this, if Israel had an army or men, just men, of 600,000 men, why would they be afraid of the Egyptians? That was what stuck in my brain all day yesterday. Why would they be afraid of the Egyptians if they had 600,000 men that could fight back? That's a question in my head. Bill?
I don't believe them at all.
Oh,
I think the scholars are bad people as a group. I don't respect them. Now, Exodus 38 reaffirms there were 603,550 men. I think that includes the Levites. But the historians just aren't useful, let's say. That's why they think the universe is 15 billion years old. That's why I think the world's 5 billion years old. They don't have a clue. That's why I think the Egyptian or Chinese history goes back 8,000 years. They're just way wrong. I looked it up even this morning. The earliest record of Egyptian chronology going back to 3100 BC, which is way wrong because the flood was around 2400 something BC. The Egyptian did not exist before the flood. That's just wrong. And they mess with history. They're bad. They're wrong. And they just don't believe God's word. And you don't really know how many Egyptians there were. And they just lied on a regular basis. And we have lots of lying historians like Josephus, who makes God a liar concerning the death of Moses, teaches a false gospel, disagrees with the Bible on facts and events, disagrees with the Bible on chronology, and himself, and he's just a pathological liar. I mean, these guys are really bad. Herodotus didn't know how King Cyrus died, so he went to a necromancer to find out the entrails from, find out how he died reading the entrails of an animal. God says it's an abomination, you know. He disagrees with Cassius and Xenophon. They can't get their story right, and there's so many. It's like, hey, yesterday's fake news is today's history, and so I don't believe that Egyptian stuff.
Well, I didn't go to the Egyptian stuff to read that. I went through J.K. Beale and John Walton and Greg Kinnear and David DeSilva. Those are the scholars of the ancient times. I don't read Josephus. I haven't read Josephus since I got for the first paragraph. I'm going, well, that's weird. And so I, you know, didn't understand it because it didn't add up to something else that I had written. So when I do my study, I go to the people who have done it longer than me, definitely. And J.K. Beale is one of the best authors you can get. She's gone now, I believe, and her books are horribly expensive. But I do have an avenue into her work through a friend of mine. So I look into her words. Her books are hard to read. They are so hard to read because they're everything. I mean, she puts everything, all his history, ancient history in it. So I don't go to, you know, some Egyptian source and say, you know, we outnumbered the Israelites and they were afraid of us. I don't do that. Greg Kinnear is one of the leading authors for Greek and Hebrew out there. So he's a wonderful man to listen to and read from. And I do get a lot of my information from him. But nobody was there. Nobody knows how many people were there. We can say, I know what the Bible says. I know what it says. But I also know that that it has been transmitted orally for years before it was written down. So just like the Hittites said, we got 40,000 people to come kick your rear ends. They didn't. We know that because they found the dead people in the ground. So you have to take some of it. You know, there's just, if you statistically and logistically, if you look at the land and you see all that, where do all those people fit? That's the biggest question I've ever had. How did they get 2 to 3 million people with the add-ons of the men, the women and the children, and the mixed multitude? Where did they all fit? And the line from Egypt to the Red Sea would have taken somewhere upwards to 3 to 7 months. If you have a caravan of women and things, the average miles per day was 6 miles per day. That's not a lot of time to travel, you know? So I think that, you know, in a way we're kind of walking around this going, well, we don't really know. And that's the way I'm going to leave it. I don't really know. I wasn't there. I didn't count the people. So I can only go by what I've read. And I'll just leave it at that. Anybody else?
I got something. Okay. Go ahead. So we all kind of know, like, God will make a way, right? Like, no matter what, he'll make a way. So, like, I kind of agree with, like, what your theory is, but I kind of disagree with some parts.
That's fine.
So it's just, like, with... like the area, like if God wants to fit how many other people it was, if it's 600,000 or 2 million, whatever, he'll make a way for them to be there. Whether move the mountains, whatever, right? And then I've always...
This is the map. Find where 600,000 can fit in this teeny, teeny, teeny little area. Right here. Right here. This is where they were. This is where Israelite. Well, I know you can't see this, but you can see it way back there. I know you can.
I tend to favor what the Bible says because it's been proven right.
You're always wrong.
Throughout all of history, people said the Hittites didn't exist. They dig a hole where the Hittites exist. They find it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Archaeological people are... they pick and choose what they want to know from the ground.
I tend to favor the 600,000 men of fighting age, and then even if you double that, that's 1.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
How many kids do you think they had? How many women? Yeah, I mean, let's just take half of that is women. 300,000 women. That's
so you're saying you're putting the women inside the 600,000?
Them out because it don't mention them. It just says 600,000 men.
And yeah.
No, it doesn't say anything about children and women.
Oh, okay. It just says beside children.
Yes.
Beside
children. That means they're not counting them.
Yeah.
If you got 600,000 men, let's say.
All right, we got 10 minutes. Yay.
Four per couple.
even if they had one.
Yeah.
All right.
That's what, 1.2 million?
Yeah.
Let's say they had two.
Damien has the microphone. Okay. He's got
no,
the topics.
No, I think it's interesting, but it's almost like we get so stuck on what we've been told by people in the past.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We sit here and we say, okay, well, based on what they say, we have to base what we look at on what they discovered. And it's like, well, did what they discover actually come through? How many people? You know, it's one after the other, and then it just comes back to the comedic side of how they make the pyramids. You know, like all these little things that they still don't have answers for, the questions that are still in the past, that it's like, how did this even happen? How did they do this? We're more advanced than them. We should know. We should be able to do that. But they had this, they had that, they were able to do this. How'd they do that? But we know everything else about them. And it's like, there's probably a lot we're missing, but you make really good points because it's things that it just doesn't make sense. But there's so many things about that time that don't make sense,
it's
that
true.
We don't get. And it's like, I feel good about hearing this because it's stuff we do need to hear, because it's like, all right, you got the Bible side, you have this. I understand the logic with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And then I understand the Bible. And it's like, but what happened?
I
feel like, though, what I always seem to come back to is there's part of me that really wants to know everything, you know? And then there's the other part that just loves discovering and learning. And I feel like that in itself is a blessing from God, that we can ask questions, learn, be wrong, then be right, and then kind of go around. There's that reward. So it's, yeah, like what you brought up, I never thought of that before.
We should be able to ask.
And that's the thing, and that's the other side. It's like, okay, well, where did they get that? Who did they hear that from? And then you just kind of keep going. And it's, to me, it's fun. It doesn't disprove Yeshua. It doesn't disprove, you know, Yahweh or anything that happened.
Anything.
It really doesn't.
From Yahweh and Yeshua and his plan, it just, we have been given the ability to reason and to think and to question.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, you know, I've been questioning things all my life. I got kicked out of my Sunday school class for asking questions.
But
you know?
We should be, and he wants us to. I feel like it's just a given. He wants us to, because it is enjoyable. I personally think so. It is enjoyable to do. Yeah.
And finding nuggets inside things. It's like the leaven, binding up the dough and everything upon their backs and their clothing and everything. And in this time I read it around, I'm going, man, that is us putting the cross on and walking forward. The burden of his word, the bread, his word, on our backs as we walk forward into the unknown. Mm-hmm. I thought that was my big, huge takeaway, besides my theory. Mm-hmm. Of course, my theory's the best. You know?
I think I actually have a final question, I feel like. Why is there so much emphasis on the unleavened bread? When he's talking about Passover, there's more put on unleavened bread than the Passover sacrifice itself. Like, he's very persistent. And we see what Paul made of it, and it's, but that's a very long way in the future. And it's like, oh, leaven, sin, like, oh, that's great. But then he's like, leaven, unleavened bread, if you even eat leaven, you're getting kicked out, unleavened bread, and it's like, but back then, like, why was that? Like, we understand, okay, because you can't wait for it to rise, but is it really that important that you're going to make it to where you can be kicked out of the Israelites, because you ate leaven? Like, what brings that substance to that, aside from what was thousands of years in the future, Paul's interpretation?
That's interesting. Yeah. It is. I love stuff like that.
Well, that's like circumcision. Yeah. It's a sign. It's a test. It's a way to honor God. You honor God.
tells you to do something, you accept your father's will. Mm-hmm. And because you love him, you do what he instructs you to do.
Yeah. Oh, I have no problem.
That's the same way with God.
It's just the emphasis is what I'm talking about. I have no
problem. There's no bearing on teaching of righteousness. Because that's what God wants to do. He wants to teach you righteous ways. To make you able to exist for eternity. Without righteous acts, without being love, like God is love, it makes no sense to live forever.
Yeah.
Because all other things are darkness. You don't want to exist in darkness for eternity.
Martin?
He's trying to teach life.
I think it's a great question, and what comes to my mind is the Lord is trying to strongly tell us we need to leave the world system behind, and for the Israelites, they were used to a point and somewhat comfortable with the food that they were getting, because once they were on the Exodus, they wanted to go back, and the leaven represents the world system and sin, so he's trying to pull his people, make them separate. Holy from the world system. And that's why I think that our current, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is important, because once you start actually practicing that week-long not eating leaven, you realize how leaven is intermixed in so much of our life. So it's possibly a foreshadow of that. And maybe because there's a couple of different important aspects to the redemption. We deal with our own sin, but also a witness to the world that we are leaving the world system, you know, as far as the unleavened bread side of it. But the sacrifice, the Passover, is a real personal thing with us, you know. So that's just a couple of thoughts I have on it.
Also with the leaven, in order to collect the leaven, they had to sit down and wait, because the leaven is in the air. And they sit down and they're waiting for it to settle somewhere, and then they could get it together and put it in their bread. So first of all, they have to wait to collect the leaven, and then they have to put it in the bread, and then they have to wait for the bread to rise. So I kind of see it as the unleavened bread was a matter of you keep moving, you keep halakha-ing, or whatever that is, the walk. You keep moving. You don't get to sit down and settle here. I want you to keep moving until you get to where I want you to be. So, I don't know. That's
well,
me.
They could, their bread could have left in that, in the trough.
Uh-huh.
And they had it wrapped up. The air could have still got in there, but it would have taken a week or so to get the leaven to get through the cloth.
Right.
So your point is just... Mm-hmm. Neat. I like that. Yeah. So, you know,
you have to wait for the leaven to get there,
yeah.
And then you have to let the bread rise. So all that takes
to
time.
Keep moving.
That's what. Anyway, that's.
I like that. I like that at all. So nobody else is. I'm going to go ahead and read the rest of it and so we can finish it off. It's 20 to 1. So the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "These are the regulations for the Passover meal. No foreigner may eat it. Any slave you have bought may eat it after you circumcise him, but a temporary resident or a hired worker may not eat it. It must be eaten inside the house. Take none of the meat outside the house. Do not break any of the bones. The whole community of Israel must celebrate it. The foreigner residing among you who wants to celebrate the Lord's Passover must have all the males in his household circumcised. Then he may take part of the one born in the like the one born in the land. No uncircumcised male may eat it. The same law applies both to the native born and to the foreigner residing among you. All the Israelites did just what the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, and on that very day the Lord brought the Israelites out of Egypt by their divisions. Divisions, that's a word. Divisions. So verse 42 tells us that it's supposed to be a night to be a much observed. And it's the word observed here is only used twice in the entire Bible, and it's right here in verse 43, which I found really, really neat. that it's just, you're not just observing a feast, but it's a vigil that we must observe every year. And to me, a vigil is something that you stare at, you know, and you observe it really, really intensely. But yet Passover is a solemn affair, but it's also a joyous affair now because we have Yeshua. And Yeshua gave us our salvation. He gave us the circumcised heart. So I'm just going to open it up to anybody who wants to comment on any of this, who the sojourner is, who is the sojourner, who is the stranger, because stranger and sojourner are two different people, believe it or not, although they can be the same person at the same time. So does anybody have anything to talk about, to ask, question about these last verses? No one? No one? Well, at least nobody can hear my stomach growling up here.
Just a quick question. In verse 46, it says, you're not to break a bone thereof. And I was just wondering, I don't know if there's anywhere else that anybody's aware of in place besides, like, Jesus not getting broken, of why it's significant that they shouldn't break a bone. And
why they didn't break the bones, I think, is what you're asking.
Yeah.
Right?
Why it's significant.
Well, Yeshua didn't have his bones broken, and the Passover always points to Yeshua. But it's also out of respect. This is a commentary from Kinnear that I liked so much, I printed it out. It says, the requirement of not breaking its bones is based on the principle of respect and reverence, as well as the principle of prophecy and fulfillment. The lamb is not to be mutilated or marred, but to be treated with dignity and honor. The lamb is not to be altered or modified, but to be preserved as a complete type and shadow of Yeshua, the Lamb of God, whose bones were not broken on the cross. And then he points to John 19 and then Psalms 34:20. So I think that's probably why, because it's something that is, I mean, obviously you got to kill the lamb after you've loved on it for, you know, a few days and how cute it is and everything, and then you got to kill it. But you don't want to you don't want to take it out and just chop it all on up and everything. It's something Passover solemn, and the life that gave you that blood for the lentil is important. So you want to, you should be able to, respect. You should respect that, I think. And that's probably all rolled up into just the fact that Yeshua was, his bones were not broken. He may have been marred, but he wasn't broken. Hiro?
Sacrifices, God wants a perfect sacrifice, right? He says, don't give me a sacrifice without any impurities, bruises, spots, that could include broken bones. That's just kind of like that, kind of correlates with, like, the lamb being the sacrifice, Yeshua is our sacrifice. It just kind of, like, goes with that.
Two things to that. One, I have learned that Yahweh has taught me, and like scriptures teach us how to be more human, more set apart children of God than animal-like. You know, if we were barbaric or whatever, we'd be breaking bones and all, you know, when we eat. That said, also, that reminds me of Genesis 2, you know, when Yahweh is creating woman, it says, and the rib which Yahweh Elohim has taken from the man, he made into woman, and he brought her to the man. So that might be connected. That might be something as a rib. I know some scripture says the side of the man,
the womb.
It wasn't ripped from him. It wasn't broken. It was just taken. It was, I don't know. That's another mystery. You know, was it, you know, just him doing his work, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's an interesting take. Yeah. So, anybody else? you know, Passover, Pesach, it's all about reverence. It's all about respect. It's all about relationship. It's, you know, Passover is actually a meal that's supposed to be done in the home. These big, huge seders and things like that, I understand why they do them, because when you're in diaspora, when you have been shattered all across the world, you want to come together with like-minded people. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with big cedars. But I personally think that Passover should be done inside your home with your family, with your loved ones, with people, like-minded people, because it tells us a little bit about our relationship with Yahweh, our relationship with Yeshua. It's about unity and fellowship and protection and security. And when you participate in that every year, you are saying to Yahweh, I accept what you have given to me, and I'm going to take this, and I'm going to walk forward in reverence and respect, and I'm going to follow what you say. So I think it's just, you know, this inclusive meal that is part of a tradition that we all do, and I think that tradition in our Passover should be respected, and because I see a lot of people, last year I saw a lot of people going weird about Passover. And I thought, well, you know, there's, God tells us specifically, you know, the parameters to do it in. I don't think you should go to the top of the mountain, kill your goat or your lamb, and then go burn it on the fire over there. That's just me. So I think that as we do Passover every year, that we take that into our memory and we identify with that every day. We identify with Yeshua and with Yahweh and with his Torah, and we keep his instructions and we follow his traditions, and we become part of Israel. And that's all I have to say today. Anybody else? Bill? And then it's time to go and eat.
Are you going to tell us some time why you got kicked out of Bible study?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Saturday is the Sabbath, and it's not on Sunday, and I know that because a Jewish lady told me. That's how it started. But before that, it was little things that I didn't agree with, you know, that because as a, you know, when you're going to Sunday school, you learn about the Old Testament stuff too. They teach you all about Genesis, and then they jump into Matthew, and there's no connection at all, and I knew how to read, and I read it, and I waited every week because my teacher was the pastor's son. And I was always in trouble for doing something or another. And I would wait, and I'd have it all written down. And we'd get there, and he'd hand us a piece of paper, and we'd have to answer the questions, and I would put my answers on and get in trouble. So anyway, that's basically, that really started it. And then after that, I didn't go to church anymore because my mother couldn't make me. You dress like a hippie and stuff, and you go to church with your flip-flops on and your hip huggers, and yeah, your mom tells you to stay at home. So will you go find John for us?